So, we're going to talk about where you were a week ago.
Yeah,
we'll a week ago tonight.
Is it a week ago today?
Yeah, I think so.
That's great.
It's Monday, November 23rd, 2015. So, you entered into a Twitter war with one of the most domineering and powerful forces on Twitter. Or at least literary Twitter.
Sure. I don't know that war is accurate.
Should we not use her name?
No, we can use Anka.
And talk around it like Voldemort.
No, I'm happy to talk about Roxane Gay. That was the same day that Tin House published Claire Vey Watkins' essay on pandering, which I had heard as a talk before, and I was very moved by it. I thought it was very smart, and I think she's very smart. I thought it was just a brilliant talk.
We'll link to that. It's an excellent essay.
It is an excellent essay. Yes. And Claire is an important person. I really have a lot of respect for how self-indicting she is in that essay. She really, I think, puts herself on the line, which I have a lot of respect for. I don't follow Roxane Gay for many reasons.
I was at home and I was very upset to find out that I had blocked her, and I then had to unblock her. Just because I didn't want to see people retweeting her. So
right,
I never followed her in the first place, so it was a preemptive block.
And she's retweeted often.
Yes.
Yeah, so I had her muted. And then I think I had posted on Twitter and Facebook, I had posted links to Claire's essay. And then I don't remember who texted me and said, "Are you seeing all the backlash against Claire's essay?"
Requisite backlash.
I was like, "No,
it's a hard thing to backlash against."
That's what I was like. What are people backlashing against? It's like such a safe essay to me in so many ways. Like, what could people possibly be shitting on? And then they were like, "Yeah, check Roxane Gay's feed or whatever." So I was like, "Okay, I'll do that." And she tweeted something to the effect of that she didn't feel a part of the us, in the rhetorical us, in Claire's essay, which ends, "Let us burn this motherfucker down to the ground and start a new one."
Sure.
Which I kind of don't understand how you can't feel a part of that, because it to me, it just seemed like such a rallying cry and an all-inclusive rallying cry to, you know,
for anyone who's sort of exasperated with the canon.
Right, to make your own. And that's, I don't see that as gendered or racial in any way. It just seemed like a very exciting thing to offer. But Roxane Gay did not feel a part of it.
Nah. And I think that's microcosmic of her character in general.
Absolutely.
That she will, maybe in it's part of her genius that she can focus on these things that will appear to be out of the normal line of thinking in terms of progressivism.
Right.
And it's hard to say. It seems as if it's against, she's the one being excluded, when in fact she's creating this sort of bubble from which anyone who doesn't agree with her is excluded.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which is probably dangerous.
Yeah. And yet I think people worship her for that reason.
Exactly.
Because they feel protected by that bubble too.
Yeah.
So not only did I think, I couldn't imagine how someone would not feel a part of that us. I also didn't see why it was pertinent for Claire Vey Watkins to, include Roxane Gay.
Well, that's the whole thing. I feel as if she were name-dropped in the essay, she would be totally fine with it and consider it a work of genius.
And also, I think, conversely, if Claire had tried to speak to the experience of women of color in that essay, I think Roxane Gay would have attacked her with the same fervor, saying that it wasn't her place to do so.
Sure.
Because that essay really is not... it's very specific. It's about Claire's experience, writing as a Western writer and as a woman and trying to please, all these white dudes and get Cormac McCarthy to like her book. it's not an experience that everyone has.
No.
And so the idea that essay, I think somebody published something in the LA Times or somewhere that was sort of an addendum to Claire's essay about women of color having to pander, and all that, which is great, and I think it's good that conversation was opened, but I think it's really ridiculous to fault Claire's essay for not having included that stuff in the first place, because it's not Claire's experience, and if she had tried to speak to that experience, I guarantee you, Roxane,
it's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely, everything is
when you're dealing with this type of progressive absolutism, yes. which is, as you said, dangerous. Yes, completely. You lose either way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But at the same time, Roxane Gay garners an enormous amount of attention for calling out these supposed transgressions against her.
Right. So I tweeted, because I couldn't help myself. I usually do, though. Like, so here's the thing, is that I have not liked Roxane Gay for quite a long time. My problems stem mostly with her work, but yes. I do have problems with her as a person, too, now. Not now. for a while.
Well, she entitled you to your rage.
She did entitle me to my rage, which is very kind. But my main problem is with her work, and not with her. And I didn't want it to seem as if I was, like, attacking her as a person.
Yeah, probably on the cultural meter, she's maybe doing more good than she is bad.
Yeah,
in terms
absolutely.
Of on a page level,
absolutely.
She's a very half-baked writer.
Which is charitable.
Yeah.
It's a charitable
description. Who garners an enormous, enormous amount of attention relative to the quality of her work.
Absolutely, yeah. And so then I tweeted something to the effect of that it was laughable for her to call out the rhetorical us when her book, I think, is one of the big problems with Bad Feminist, which I did read. I read the entire thing. I didn't pay for it. I had a galley of it. But,
I took it out from the library.
Not very good for you. but I think one of the big problems with that book is that the rhetorical we in that book is really a straw man. So I said that it was laughable for her to call out the us when she had used this we that was such a bullshit. And then some one of her, fans said, like, what do you mean false we's? Like, what? And so then I gave examples. Like, she says stuff like we put all this responsibility on the movie Bridesmaids, which, like, no, we don't. I don't.
Bridesmaids is terrible. I'll also, like, edit it so okay. It makes coherent sense.
Well, Bridesmaids is not terrible.
Bridesmaids isn't terrible. It's terrible for the space that it occupies in terms of, like, feminist, as, like, a call to arms, I think, for feminism. It's a movie about women being jealous of one another because of who has the nicest dress and who's best friends with whom, and it's directed by a man.
Right, but I also think it's a comedy. Like, it never wanted to be what Roxane Gay's We thinks it was supposed to
right,
be.
Right. It was very largely miscast.
And I think it just wanted to be a movie. Like, someone shits in a sink in that movie. It's not trying to be, like, a fucking...
That's another thing I hate. It's also in Pitch Perfect and a lot of movies in which there's large female casts that there's some sort of power in them either, like, throwing up or pooping.
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
I don't understand. Right. It's probably just for gross-out humor's effect, but I don't understand how it's equatable to them sort of inserting themselves into the comedy mainstream.
Right. Yeah, no, it's easy.
It's very easy.
And I think that's in all dude movies, too.
Totally.
Just shitting and throwing up.
Shouldn't they not want that, then?
I guess. But yeah, so then that's sort of Roxane's wheeze is that. And then also, like, wheeze phrases like rape shower. And I was like, I've never even heard that phrase until I read it in your book.
What is a rape shower?
I don't know.
Is it a shower of rape?
I think it's like,
Is it like a light drizzle that makes everyone want to rape people?
No, I think it's like you just give yourself a little pat down or something, like a post rape shower.
Oh, after you get raped, you take a shower.
Right. And I'd never heard that phrase before. So the idea that we are saying me, like in quotes, we are saying this, is ridiculous. And she's a PhD in rhetoric, which is bad.
From MIT.
The Michigan Institute of Technology.
Oh, we'll laugh about that.
You can leave that
in. I'm not cutting that out. I'll leave that one for you.
Thank you. Even still, like, she has a degree in rhetoric, and I find it staggering how poorly her rhetoric looks and sounds on the page.
Yeah.
I mean, she really, I think, has the rhetorical skills of a kid in a candy store who's, like, not getting what they want and, like, is tugging on the sleeve of their parent. And that's what I was calling out.
I have a very basic litmus test for criticism. One of them is, I mean, I'm not a fan of the iVoice, but obviously she's a big proponent of the iVoice. Yeah. And my other one, which is probably insane, is that I just count how many times a critic or someone uses the word interesting. Which is like the ultimate placeholder criticism in my mind.
And it's a way to not take a side.
Yeah, it's something that everyone knows what it means, but it actually means nothing.
Right.
Sort of creates a very easy.
Yeah.
Say this is either interesting or not interesting, that's a clicks in our brain, but it actually doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
So, she's a big interesting user. Like, yes. I think there's one essay that begins, "The beach is in sand is interesting," or "The beach is interesting."
Oh, that essay is horrible. That's not in her book. That's in the New York Times. It's about, like, going to the beach.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's staggering that was, like, included as an essay in the New York Times. Yeah, I just think she's not a good writer.
Yes.
I read the first chapter of her novel at Book People.
Which I hear is better than...
The language was better, but I also saw that it was clearly not going to be a book that I would enjoy. It has a similar martyr complex that I think she also has.
Particularly on Twitter against you.
Yes, yeah, she's poor writer.
I guess you're the martyr in terms of the
I'm not the martyr.
The mob turning against you.
Oh, I don't, but yeah, but see, like, the great thing about it is that I don't give a shit about anything. And people, like, direct message me and email me and text me and are like, are you okay?
Well, this
I'm
is...
like, I'm great.
This
I'm
is what like, I thought was so refreshing and great, because so much of literary Twitter is this, like, earnest backpatting session in which everyone walks in a continuous circle slapping each other on the back for... usually inconsequential or undeserved things that they've accomplished in terms of literary community. But you obviously went against the grain, because I think most people are like, in their mind, they're following Roxane Gay on Twitter and they're eventually going to get a blurb on the back of their novel that they write during National Novel Writing Month. And it's just like, it's a ludicrous thing, but it seems like everyone who makes a Twitter and puts writer period, you know, after.
Yeah, it's, I think... that's true of a lot of literary Twitter, but I think it's especially true of people responding to Roxane Gay. I have had a well-liked, well-known novelist, who I'll tell you after, I'm not going to say his name on the podcast, but we talked about Roxane Gay, and he's a man of color too, I should say that. He completely agreed with everything I said, and then urged me not to ever say anything about it in public. And he said it would be, quote, career suicide.
See, these are the things that are just ludicrous.
And at first I was like, well, you're giving her way too much credit. Yes. She doesn't have that much power. But then you do think, like, okay, a lot of people like her. And she does know a lot of people. But
do you want to be liked by those people?
No, that's the thing. Like, I don't give a shit about my career. I care about the quality of my work. And that's basically it. Like, I was never going to get a blurb from her in the first place. Nor would I want one. I'm a better writer than she is, and I also think I'm a better rhetorician than she is. So I have no qualms in calling out what I believe to be, like, bogus criticism.
Yes, which you should as a critic.
I think that's your job. Yeah. And she does it all the time, whether, you know, invalid or valid, or, you know, who cares. But so yeah, I said that, and then she said. She wrote, like, with, like, four M's, period.
Classic rhetoric.
Okay, period. And then this is what she does. Then she leaves your Twitter handle up. So, like, it'll be, okay, my Twitter handle. And that is my problem with her as a person, which is different than my problem with her work, is that she does not fight her own battles. She leaves your name up, knowing that her, like, 80,000 followers, which are, you know... need half a reason to attack a white man. which I understand. They probably have a right to do that.
Sure.
She
white men are terrible.
Yes, absolutely. She knows that if she leaves it up there, she doesn't have to do anything. Like, they will come for me immediately, which they did.
She honestly has a tweet in which she sticks her followers on you.
Yes, she literally, right, exactly.
Mentioned you by name, which we will read right now.
Yeah.
Exactly. Roxane Gay, November 23rd, 11:07 p.m. Followers, there is no need to engage Vincent Scarpa. He is entitled to his opinions in rage.
Which is so kind of her to grant me that entitlement.
Very nice. To which you responded.
Go ahead, read it. I don't care.
Roxane Gay is an opportunistic, self-satisfied, malignant growth on literature. I pray you'll unfollow if you disagree. And how many people unfollowed you?
Zero.
And how many followed you?
18.
Oh, nice.
Very happy
making. It's an excellent ratio.
It was
so.
Very happy making.
Yes. So the people who said that your career would be destroyed if you would ever speak.
And you know what bothers me about her tweet is not the idea that, like, I'm entitled. Like, I know I'm entitled. To my opinions, but rage, like, really, like, do you know what rage looks like? I'm from New Jersey. I grew up in a trailer park. Like, you have no idea what my rage looks like. I said that, you know, that was, I said hardly anything about her at that point, and it was automatically rage. And she tweeted something like, I wish I had thicker skin for random unwarranted attacks. Just bullshit. It's just, it's a complete martyr.
It's a nice victim call.
And it's like, don't fucking come to the playground if you don't want to play.
Yes.
And I have no respect for people who don't fight their own battles. I would never, if I had that seat of power, would never imagine just leaving someone's name up there for my army to, like, attack them. It's bullshit.
Yes.
But they did.
I mean, subtweet them.
Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to do. Like,
right. Be passive aggressive.
When I would make fun of Grantland writers and they would find my blog post, they would always subtweet me before they would say, like, this guy's an asshole.
Right, right.
And that's the type of
character
we're looking for.
Right. And so they all came after me. Here's the thing. I'm happy to always engage in, like, in intellectual debate, always. I really am. But I can't do it with people who are 100% humorless.
Yes.
And the people who contacted me through her were 100% humorless.
Earnesty monsters.
Yes. And I just can't. There's something in me that cannot fuck with those people. So I would just say stuff like, you know, people, you know, people, someone said, like, you're attacking a woman of color. And I was like, I can't even dignify that as, like, a criticism. So I was just like, no, I'm not. I just think all lives matter, and I'm voting for Dr. Ben Carson.
Sure.
And then he was like, well, of course you're a Republican. And I was like, look at my fucking Twitter, you idiot. Of course I'm not a Republican. I have a Bernie Sanders bumper sticker on my Prius, you asshole. Like, I'm not, but those people are so humorless that there's something in me that can't help fucking with them.
How can you not? You're dealing with an intelligence that isn't going to be able to grasp what you're trying to broach them with.
Exactly.
So why even bother?
So, yeah, and there was just a bunch of that and a bunch of, like, I've seen Roxane Gay's book in airports, and I've never even heard of this guy. I was like, because that's how you measure intelligence, is whether or not someone's book is in airports.
I mean, James Patterson is a very intelligent man.
And like, I've never seen him on the New York Times bestseller list. And I was like, well, Snooki's been on there. That's like, that's a terrible gauge.
These are excellent rubrics.
Like, what is it? What the fuck does that matter?
It's very, I mean, this is obviously a sort of, like, name recognition level.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right. Scale. And that's right. What they're doing.
What they worship.
Right. And I thought something you asked that was really interesting in our pre-interview, not to, like, bust the mythos of the podcast, but there was a pre-interview.
The mythos.
Is, like, how, like, what space she sort of occupies and how.
Yes.
How I sort of think of her.
What market inefficiency that she corrects with her persona.
Right.
And her writing.
And I think that, and this is probably what my big issue is, like, why I get upset that she has as much recognition or, not power is not the right word, but, you know,
cultural capital.
Yeah, capital. That totally, she wields. Right. Is that I think she is 100% a paint by numbers progressive. She has said nothing interesting ever, nothing challenging ever.
Nah.
Her book, the whole point of Origin is false. Feminism is not a qualitative practice. You can't be good or bad at it. It's a set of beliefs. So that the whole thing is sort of a ruse to me, or like a forced card. And her idea that, you know, she'd been made to feel, you know, quote unquote, bad at feminism for liking the color pink or for liking rap music is completely self.
It's pure projection.
It's complete bullshit. And she openly admits to not having read Judith Butler in Bad Feminist. And
which is fine.
No, see, I don't think it is, because if you're trying to contribute to a field, like feminist theory, which that book is marketed as.
True.
And I think Roxanne would describe it as feminist theory. I sort of feel like, how dare you not read Judith Butler? How dare you not read Gender Trouble?
Well, then what does she have to sell if she reads Judith Butler?
Right. But even if to disagree with it, like, Judith Butler is one of the sort of the main people in this field who's writing about this kind of stuff. And like, who are you to just openly disavow it and say, like, I'm just going to write, you know, fly by the seat of my pants and not read Butler or any of those people. So again, I don't think she's ever said anything interesting or intellectual.
Well, which is what makes the book so attractive, because it gives you a badge of honor for lacking intellectual curiosity.
And it requires nothing of you.
Whatever you're doing is great. Right. You're a great feminist no matter what.
It requires absolutely nothing of you. It challenges you on nothing. And yet, she has come to sort of occupy this seat as like a voice of radicality, which I find fascinating, because there's nothing radical about her at all. She is not challenging the status quo on anything that she talks about. And, you know, for a long time, I think it's actually settled down a little bit now, but anytime there would be any event in the news, you could always sort of count on Roxanne Gay having a think piece on it the next day.
See, this is what I lose not following her on Twitter.
I mean, I would see it retweeted by other people, and people post about it on Facebook. It feels very opportunistic when someone has written a think piece about something that happened the day before.
It doesn't allow for a lot of thinking.
No, how much thought went into that? Like, not much if you're churning it out the next day and getting paid for it. So I think of, like, writers like Maggie Nelson, who I think actually is radical. And The Argonauts is a book that really challenges feminist theory and queer theory, and
which puts a very low ceiling on its popularity.
Exactly,
it's challenging.
Right, exactly. And that's my problem, is that people, you know, and this is, you see this everywhere, people don't want to be challenged.
Yes.
They want to be coddled. And no one will coddle your, you know, paint-by-numbers progressive bullshit like Roxanne Gay will.
You'd rather eat cotton candy feminism
than
escargot.
And Maggie Nelson doesn't dumb herself down for her readers. Like, she expects you to rise to the occasion and look up shit if you don't know what she's talking about, which I admire, but yeah, totally. No one was wearing t-shirts that said The Argonauts, you know? Whereas, like, I was at Tin House before Bad Feminist even came out, and people were wearing Bad Feminist shirts, and I thought, this is, like, vaguely fascist. If you don't even know what the book is about, you haven't read the book, it's not even out yet, but you're already endorsing the sort of the main concept of the book by wearing this shirt. And also decontextualize.
It's a blind followership that is basically what exists on the right.
It's late fascism. Yeah. It's complete fascism. Yeah. And I'm like, you haven't even read
the book. Followers on someone. She's like Mussolini.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, luckily I don't give a shit, and I had a fucking great time.
It made my Tuesday night.
I think people are genuinely concerned for me.
Concerned for, like, bricks going through your window?
Yeah, and they're like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm having the time of my life with this. Like, I've been wanting to do this for a while.
Yeah.
And this felt like the right occasion for it. And the fact that she was like, I'm friends with Claire Watkins, and I'm teaching Battleborn. I was like, good for you. I'm not friends with Claire Watkins. I have less to gain from this.
What does that prove?
Yeah, like, that, like, yeah, exactly.
Teach Mein Kampf?
Right. Exactly. It's the equivalent of, I have a black friend, I'm not racist. Which I was accused of, you know, being a racist, being a sexist. And I just can't entertain that. Like, if you know me beyond that one interaction, I think you know that I predominantly read women. I read a lot of people of color. Like, I just can't, I'm not going to dignify that
shit. So you have
a
black friend?
I have tons of black friends. So many. And then somebody else is like, well, what writers do you, you know, who is a good writer? And I was like, I can't not do this. So I just listed all white women. I was like, Maggie Nelson, Yula Biss, Leslie Jamison, Lydia Yuknovich. And then they were like, they're all white women. And I was like, I love James Baldwin, too. I couldn't help myself. These people are so ridiculous. So, yes, that was the story. I think she's awful. And
we win again.
White men. Yes, thank God, right? I mean, that's the thing, is that I didn't...
I think from the outside looking in, it appears if that is what... our argument is.
Right. Like, and that's she's why wrong, I didn't. Right. And to be honest, that's why I didn't ever publish anything about Bad Feminist. Like, I never published a review about it. I wrote one, and it was, I think, therapeutic to write it. But I was like, who is ever going to take this seriously or take it for what it is and not view it through the lens of, like, this is a 25-year-old white dude writing about a book called Bad Feminist, written by a black queer woman of color.
Which is the censorship that feminism should be against.
Right, right.
Because it's discounting someone because of their gender.
Sure, but I also understand
that a lot.
So I never published it, so...
You don't need another Bad Feminist review except the one that was in book forum.
That
was
great.
Which is the only one.
And then also Lauren Euler, I think is her name.
Yes, something. Yes, yes. Really wonderful. Hers is excellent, too.
Yeah, I retweeted the shit out of that when that came out. And Roxane Gay did not care for that at
all. I'm sure she didn't.
Because she can't take criticism. And the inability to take criticism.
Which is a fascinating field to get into if you can't take criticism.
Like thank
being,
you.
Being a writer and a public intellectual. I'm putting up very thick, all four fingers scare quotes around that.
Yeah, because she's not really intellectual. I mean, she has not demonstrated anything to me that proves that she's actually an intellectual. I don't think of her as a deep-thinking person.
Has she been on Seth Meyers?
God, is that a Lauren Groff?
That's a Lauren Groff. No, or I thought Lauren Groff was great on there.
She was.
Tanya was great too. Yeah. I'm happy that he's having authors.
Me too. That is very exciting because no writers have been on TV in like 20 years.
No, I think Colbert had a couple.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. But like Dick Cavett used to have like Norman Mailer and Gordon Dahl like punch each other. And now it's like, I want that.
That's
back.
What you need. This is why literature has seeped into the background of culture because there are no good battles like you versus Roxane.
And I'm happy to be Gordy Dahl. I'm so happy. I'll take a punch to the face. Like I totally deserve it.
Although you were the recipient of the Norman Mailer Fiction Award.
Yes, I was.
So I guess you would be
And
Mailer.
I lived in the apartment where he stabbed his wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I've never read it.
Did she survive?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, good for her.
And I never read his work. Still to this day, I've not read his work.
Interviewed
me. They were doing some video for next year's gala. And they're like, we want to interview you on the steps, you know, next to the apartment. And the first question he asks me is like, what was the first Norman Mailer book you ever read? So I was like, I'm going to make a bullshit of this. So I said that I had read The Executioner's Song in 10th grade.
There you
which,
go.
Of course, it was like 900 pages. I've never read that book. But just the idea that this fucking, 15-year-old is reading The Executioner's Song. Yeah, so I've never read Norman.
You've been selling lies since the beginning.
Totally. And I, like...
This smear campaign.
I didn't apply. It definitely was not... I didn't apply for that award because it was Norman Mailer. I applied because it was, money.
You don't feel a connection to his work?
I don't.
That you've never read?
That I've never read, right. I mean, I probably think I wouldn't. Didn't he, beat his wife on camera? No, that's...
Well, I know Bukowski. He stabbed one of his wives.
He stabs... Bukowski was the one who punched his wife on camera.
Well, I mean, if I want to Charles Bukowski poetry award, I would give it back.
And if he punched her on camera, he punched her a lot off camera.
Yeah. Talk about refrigerator magnet literature. Like, Bukowski is right up there with Roxane Gay.
And E. Cummings.
How dare you? He's one of the good ones.
I want to plug this documentary. You haven't seen it probably yet. Best of Enemies.
That's assuming, and I've seen that documentary.
No, you haven't.
The Norman Mailer.
No.
Oh, no.
It's Gordy Dahl and William Buckley Jr.
Oh, no. I've watched part of it.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I think it is, one of the smartest documentaries I've seen in such a long time.
That's not saying a lot.
That's true. But it makes me yearn for, the days of real public intellectual discourse that had everything to do with fact, first of all, and also got ugly, too. Yeah. I want that.
The word crypto-fascist is thrown around a lot in that documentary, is like...
Because he calls him a crypto-fascist Nazi.
Yeah.
And then which, I love Gordy Dahl. And then Buckley says, you queer, I'll punch you in the face and you'll stay plastered. I miss that. Why can't we have that?
Well, I guess...
Seth Meyers isn't going to do that.
No, he's not. He's very flattering. He definitely doesn't read the books.
No.
I guess he
didn't read Hanya's book.
Rap beefs have assumed the space of literary feuds.
That's fair.
I mean, they're the world's most successful working poets are rappers, and now they've...
Yeah, and they call each other out in their songs. They subtweet one another in their songs.
Richard Ford spit in Colson Whitehead's face.
Really?
Yeah. Because he gave a bad review of Canada, I think.
That book was horrible.
It's not my favorite of his. I wouldn't say it's terrible.
I thought it was shit. But I also don't think it would warrant a stand.
You read Wildlife?
No.
Wildlife I really like.
I've read Canada and Rock Springs.
Okay, I haven't read Rock Springs.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Those are great stories. I'm sure it's nowhere near as good as Let Me Be Frank With You.
How dare you?
That's the worst title in the world.
Not the best title, but
it is the worst title.
worse than On the Road.
Yeah, totally worse than that. It's to me, it's a tie between that, the, well, I've already forgotten what it's called. Let Me Be Frank With You. The Bill Clegg book, Did You Ever Have a Family?
Nope.
Which is a horrible title.
Also a horrible book.
I haven't read it, nor would I ever
want to. We're going to transition soon to the New York Times notable list, but I was very happy that that was left off.
Yeah, it seemed and like a terrible book.
Yes.
But
also an amazing pan, which we should... We'll call
who panned
Dwight Garner panned it.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, yeah, I did read that.
Excellent pan.
It was a horrible book. I mean, it seemed like a horrible book. It's a horrible title. And but truly my least favorite title is Marilynne Robinson, When I Was a Child, I Read Books. Which Classic. Is like a brag. Like, you somehow managed to brag in the title of your book that you're smarter.
I'm very over the fetishization of the child who reads.
It's who cares?
The most boring superhero origin story you can have.
And, like, it just has, like, a cadence to it. Like, well, when I was a child, I read books.
It's Matilda. Like, it's just Matilda.
Exactly. It's just Matilda. I have no respect for those titles. And I guess I also don't... I don't love Gold Beam Citrus, but I love that book.
I like that title a lot.
I don't like that title. It just doesn't make any sense.
I don't like that it's repeated so many times in the book.
That's probably why I don't like it.
Yes.
Because it felt very on the nose.
Yeah. Leave it inexplicable next time.
Yeah. Make it a little vague.
People will figure it out.
They will.
Yeah.
She's wonderful. I really do love her.
Great writer.
I think she's a terrific writer. I was surprised. So if we're transitioning over to the New York Times.
She was left off.
She was left off. Yes. I was very surprised by that.
I wasn't overjoyed with the book, but I thought it was a really strong book with like really strong writing in it.
Yeah, that I really love the ending.
Was maybe too hindered by plot. Oh, see, I do not like the ending.
Oh, I really do. The last like three pages.
Spoilers.
Spoiler. Yeah. I thought the last three pages were beautiful.
I thought the ending, it felt as if she was didn't know where to go, and she really...
Oh, have you read The Awakening by Kate Chopin?
I have not.
It really reminded me of the ending of that book, not because both women drown.
My cousin's wife just told me that's the best woof book ever written.
I really do love that book. Yeah. I have a tattoo from that book.
Oh.
I really love that book a lot. And they actually have a lovely, whatever publishing house does that, like Novel House, I think it is. It does like The Art of the Novella.
Yes.
They republished that, and it's a beautiful cover. But that book ended similarly to The Awakening. And I think I had maybe a little more love for it because it brought that to mind.
Maybe it was an homage.
It might have been. It might have been. Although, according to Claire's talk, she really hadn't been reading many women. She had been reading a lot of white dudes.
It felt as if she, this is probably what On Pandering was about, that she constrained herself too much with the post-apocalyptic loves, like lost love and then caring for the child on your own.
Yeah. I think you and I are both sort of, we've talked about being sort of done with post-apocalyptic for now.
Even more so than post-apocalyptic, I'm done with cults. Cults like literary go-to.
And film, too. Like, there's always...
It's an obsession.
Although I did love, I can't remember the name of the movie, or really what it was about.
or the title or anything that happens in it.
Oh, it's going to come to me. Hold on. The Sound of My Voice.
Oh, I've seen this one. No.
It was a cult movie, but it was really good. I liked it.
Like Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
I love that movie.
Great movie.
Totally good movie.
But that really doesn't push the like seductive cult leader with long hair who like, I mean, it does, but like in a very subtle way. But like, how many times do we have to see this like early 30s, attractive, charismatic cult leader seduce young women? It's such so tired.
That movie was wonderful.
I'm reading Station 11 now, and I was just waiting for it, and there it is on like page 75. Like,
I haven't read that one. I know people like her.
I'm not enjoying it.
Well, that's good to hear. I was going to say something about Martha. What's that movie called?
Martha Marcy, May, Marlene?
Yeah.
Maybe?
That is a great movie. And
excellent Elizabeth Olsen performance.
Wonderful.
Yes.
I don't know that she's done anything since then or anything.
She's in Avengers.
Oh, I haven't seen that movie. But I know that I wanted to mention, I don't think maybe you've seen this. I don't
know. You make so many assumptions about my filmmaking. Like,
no one saw this movie. Queen of Earth. Elizabeth Moss.
Yes, I have seen this movie. The guy who did Listen Up, Philip. Yes,
yeah. Which I really like Listen Up, Philip.
Oh, see, I think that movie's absolutely awful.
Oh, I thought
it should
be
struck from the face of the earth.
I thought it was funny. It's so Queen of Earth was totally different.
Yes.
And
that was excellent.
It was one of the best movies I've seen this year. And it had a similar vibe to the Martha Marcy May Marlene movie.
I had a lot of anti-Listen Up, Philip tweets that I actually thought about going back and deleting because of how good Queen of... No, I thought it was absolutely terrible. disjointed in such an artificial way.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a...
So what if we just followed a side character down like a little rabbit hole?
It wasn't wonderful, but I was delighted by how vicious it was, I guess.
I thought it was very faux vicious.
Probably.
Yes.
But any kind of vicious is pretty good.
I mean, rage is now just...
My rage, yeah. Let's talk about my rage
more. Rage is just like extinct from society now.
That's true.
Any wildness is
seen as... I miss it.
Yeah.
That's what I'm here for.
We'll bring it back.
Yeah.
That's what Twitter... what's great about Twitter. It really is a great vehicle for
rage.
For rage, yeah. You can really just dump stuff on there. Yeah, this podcast too.
Which is called Baby Photos of...
That's what it's called.
What is it called? Baby...
Baby Pictures of pictures. Famous Dictators.
I like that.
It's a Deep Infinite Jest reference.
Oh, God. I gotta go. Strike me from the podcast.
Let's compare your...
I've never read it. I can't.
Compare your Kate Chopin tattoo to my David Foster Wallace one.
Do you have a David Foster Wallace
tattoo?
I do not know that.
Yeah, I have the chapter marker.
Is that what all the chapters are marked for?
Yes.
Oh.
That's how I get my street cred.
Right.
I'm actually really over him now, and I kind of want to get it removed.
See?
I'm joking. He's a great writer. Fuck the cult.
Did you see End of the Tour?
I did. I thought it was okay.
Yeah, I thought the same.
Yes.
I thought What's-His-Name was pretty good, actually.
They're great actors. They're both great actors.
Yeah, I thought he did a good job.
Yeah.
Props to him. The movie was kind of boring, but...
The movie was nothing.
Yeah. It was
a cash-in.
I should not shit on David Foster Wallace because I've not read him.
Oh, okay. You're definitely at a point to criticize him.
I mean, I've not read him enough. I've read stories and a few essays, and I get it, but he's just not... I don't think he's for me.
He was, I think, co-opted by maybe people who now like Roxane Gay, like a sort of mindless following that was kind of adverse to his own character.
Yeah, and I think he's just like a maximalist, and that's not my cup of tea.
No. But he actually, in a sense, isn't, though, because everything on the page needs to be there, I feel like. It's all essential.
There's no way that's true.
It's an essential maximalism.
If you can't... I don't remember who said this. Maybe Jobert. It was like that no good work of writing should take more than a day to read. And if you can't read it in a day...
I completely disagree with that.
I kind of agree with that. Like, I can't think of any book that I couldn't read in a full day that's really great.
Oh, well, I just patently... Oh, what about The Instructions?
Never read it.
I thought you said you loved that book.
No. Was it Thomas Bernhard?
No, it's Adam Levin.
No, I don't even
know. McSweeney's book from 5 or 6 years ago?
No.
Oh, it's fucking amazing.
His name
amazing.
Is One Letter Off from Adam Levine.
Yes, he's very close. It might be my favorite book.
The Illusion, it's called?
The Instructions.
The Instructions. I've never said I liked that book.
Oh, well, no, you had a post. This is great, like radio. You had a post on Instagram that said, Slocum Dies Friday. You took a picture of it. And I said, maybe the best book of the century so far. And you said, totally. And that's a reference to The Instructions.
No, that picture said, we destroy we.
Yeah, that's from The Instructions.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. I just thought it was really funny graffiti.
Sorry, I was referencing the wrong instructions.
I thought you were saying that picture was the greatest book of the year. I was like, I kind of...
It's very close. No, we destroy we is from The Instructions.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's transition to the people are terribly bored.
Oh, my God.
They have totally...
As I said, yeah.
New York Times...
The New York Times Notable Books List. They release 100 books every year, 50 fiction, 50 nonfiction. We have read a combined 13 of them. I think you said you read 8 or 10.
I don't think I even said how many I read.
No, I'm making it up then.
I read a good deal of them. I could tell you which ones I read.
How many did you read?
Let me count.
For whatever reason, I read all the ones that are 750 pages or longer.
So yeah, see, that's why...
That counts as, like, 10, right?
Yeah. Basically? Well, I'll just tell you which one. I read... the ones that I was excited to see on there that I have read. Delicious Foods, which I loved. Citizen, of course. The Complete Stories of Clarice Lispector, which I loved so much. The First Bad Man, which wasn't perfect, but I thought it was decent. Fortune Smiles, which I love. And we're going to talk
excellent
about.
Collection.
Excellent collection. Excellent very happy collection. Won the National Book Award. Loving Day by Matt Johnson. Really loved that book a lot. A Manual for Cleaning Women, the Lucia Berlin series,
excellent.
Badass. Outline by Rachel Cusk, I really liked. The Sellout, the Paul Beatty book, I thought was really good. The Story of My Teeth, the Valerie Louis, I can't pronounce her last name, but that book is awesome.
Oh.
And it's one of the weirdest books I've ever read.
Well,
that's really interesting. I can't remember who put it out. It's not $2 Radio, but it's someone like them.
Keep talking.
But it's really good. The Folded Clock, the Heidi Julevitz book, I thought was wonderful. And then my two favorite books of the year are both on there, which are The Visiting Privilege, which is the collected stories of Troy Williams, and The Argonauts, Maggie Nelson's book. So I was happy.
Story of My Teeth is put out by Coffee House Press. Thank you, Coffee House Press. This podcast is
now brought to you
by Coffee House.
But yeah, I was very happy to see that my two favorite books were on there of the year.
Well, two of my least favorite books of the year were on it. A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara and City on Fire by Garth Riss Calvert.
I can't believe you read both of those books to their end.
Yeah, certainly. That's I finish every book I start.
I gave up on A Little Life like 400 pages in.
Well, you only had 600 pages to go.
I don't think I disliked it as much as you did. I just felt like I could read five other books instead of this book.
Read 10 and maybe one of them would be good and you would have made out in the end.
I thought she was a decent writer. I don't think she was a bad writer, but oddly, the longer a book is, I think the sort of more narrow I want the scope to be for some reason. Like, it's going to be 800 pages. I don't want to follow four people. I'd rather read four different novels. Like, I'd rather follow one person for 800 pages and really get into the shit.
Well, the instructions is exactly like
that. Well, maybe I'll read that. So, have you read any of those books that I read?
I have read Fortune Smiles. All the other ones are still on my to-reads list.
What?
Yes.
You didn't read the Crystal Spectre book?
I did not.
Oh my god, it's so good. Or The Sellout? You read The Sellout.
I did not read The Sellout.
What the fuck?
These are all on my to-reads list. This is why I brought you on. You're the specialist to talk about this list.
But definitely people need to read The Visiting Privilege. I thought that book was going to make I guess I was, more hopeful that it was going to make a big splash, and I really didn't. It got a great review on the Times. They did that profile, which was not great.
Not a great profile.
They called her biblically wrinkled, which is like, fuck you, dude. I should have written that profile.
Biblically
wrinkled, which you would never say of Cormac McCarthy. You would never go out of your way to say he's biblically wrinkled. And you know what? She has lived in Key West in Arizona for 40 years.
Rough on the skin.
Of course she's biblically wrinkled. Like, who cares? She's the most important writer alive. And I think the best chronicler of American greed and devastation. And I think she's one of the best sentence makers in the world. I mean,
she's an incredibly important writer who will in 50 years when she's dead, will receive acclaim that she deserves.
I hope so. And then I was glad to see The Argonauts is on there because I think that was a very important book.
I have read selections of that and it's very, very, very good.
It's wonderful. And then books that seemed unwarranted that were on there. Ages for Hawk, which I found interminably boring. Really boring book. I'm reluctant to say this because I love her so much, but The Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, the Carrie Brownstein book.
Not the best?
No. Oh, which, I love Slater Kinney, and I've loved them forever, and I love Carrie Brownstein a lot. But yeah, it was just a thin book.
I think you're seeing the intensification of now, the celebrity books, the alt-celebrity book cycle is becoming so intense now.
And who would have thought Kim Gordon would be a better sentence-level writer than Carrie Brownstein? I mean, she can't even, form sentences in interviews.
Well, the Aziz Ansari book is probably my, reference point. That. Okay. Also, the Lena Dunham book. Two books that I read, which I was very excited not to see.
I've never read the Lena Dunham. You really?
Huh?
You really liked
Lena? No, they were both absolutely horrible. Okay, some of the worst books I read this year, but...
She wasn't on there, right?
Certainly not, which is surprising. Well, I'm actually a fan of the NYT Notable List because it's where you actually see their tastes come out, feel like.
And although, what does notable mean?
What does it mean?
what is the definition of
books
notable?
That you should read, I suppose? It's worthy of note?
There's no, right, that doesn't really seem like that.
It's a lukewarm...
it's not an endorsement.
It should just be 100 best books of the year.
Right, you might as well just say that. The Guardian says, when they do their list, it's the 100 best books of the year.
But it also allows you to it allows you some wiggle room in terms of saying the best.
Right.
I don't know if you recall, Ailette Waldman had a nervous breakdown last year because she wasn't on the 100 notable list.
Yeah, I do. She tweeted a bunch about it, right?
Yes.
What was her book, the Nathaniel something? The Love Affairs of Nathaniel?
Oh, wait, no, I'm thinking of... No. I'm mixing up Ailette Waldman with the woman who's married to Michael Chabon, Adele. Ah, she has that great essay about liking her husband more than her kids.
Oh, I don't know that.
Start talking and I'll look her up. Mixing up names.
What else did I... Was I bummed? Not bummed, but I was... I guess I'm one of the... I'm probably nearly alone in this, but I don't really understand what was so great about the Charlie D'Ambrosio loitering those essays.
I've read a couple of them.
I didn't really get what the fucking big deal was.
Ailette Waldman.
Ailette Waldman.
Yes. She's looking for the definition of notable as well.
Okay. Yes. I, yeah, I don't really know what it means. So I wasn't crazy about loitering. I haven't finished The Mare, but it's definitely not Gateskill at her best, so I don't think it needed to be on there.
The Mare.
Seeing her read from that book was one of the weirdest experiences of my life. I mean, it was really uncomfortable to look at Mary Gateskill and then hear her reading first-person Ebonics was really just cognitive dissonance. And then, what else? I thought that Honeydew, the Edith Perlman stories were fucking boring.
James Wood loved them.
Of course he did. And then Fates and Furies. I thought, I read that and I didn't love it or hate it, but I don't know that it was...
Did you find it to be front-loaded?
Yes, completely. Yeah. And I've actually read all of Lauren Groff's books. And I think that...
I think Delicate Edible Birds is incredible.
I think she is a near-perfect story writer and has no idea how to end a novel. And I think that probably stems from her having a background in short stories.
For sure.
Because...
You need less definitiveness
totally,
toward the end.
Totally. And the first half of Fates and Furies really does feel like a long story. Like, it has the architecture of a story, and then you see sort of the pressure in the Fury section of, like, having to end a novel. And that's just, it's not as satisfying. And I felt the same way about Arcadia. That's what that book was called.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You gave me a look, and I was nervous.
I was trying to remember, she has Arcadia, Fates and Furies, and there's a third one about...
The,
Hippies?
No, that's Arcadia.
Oh, that is Arcadia.
She just has two novels.
Okay.
But yeah, Delicate Edible Birds is such a great collection.
Excellent.
It's and stories that are not published in a book yet that are great too. I mean, she's had a couple in Best American, the one that they put out this year that Lori Moore edited, the like 100 mm-hmm. year collection. Her story in that is so great. Can't remember what it's called. Eyewall. That's what it's called.
Oh, Eyewall.
It's really good.
It's depressing that we'll be dead by the time they do one of those for the century.
I know.
Everyone's missing out.
I don't know that... I expected it to be on the notable list because it did make a big splash.
Well, it is the favorite for the Pulitzer, right?
Is it?
I believe so.
I can't imagine it winning the Pulitzer.
No?
No.
Who do you think's going to win?
I think Hanya has a good chance.
I highly doubt if she didn't win those two, she'll win that.
I mean, Adam Johnson won't win because he already won once. I would love Joy to win.
I'm sure they'll give her a finalist. Then
she's been a finalist.
Too, yeah,
it pisses me off so much. She fucking lost to what the hell book was it that won that year? I feel like it was Michael Chabon, Cavalier and Clay.
That book's amazing, though.
There's no way anything that... no one has written a better book than Joy Williams' worst book. That's what I feel.
That seems like an absolutist viewpoint.
It is. Absolutely, it absolutely is. And then, were there books that you were surprised were not on there?
Well, I say that the New York Times notable list some, like, reveals their actual opinions, and I think some of the reviews are kind of shillery for the published, like, either the publishers are advertising in their pages
totally.
Or advertising the book in their pages, because I believe the review of Joshua Cohen's Book of Numbers called it, if you put Philip Roth and David Foster Wallace in a particle accelerator and turned it up to its highest possible setting, and basically, like, ejaculated all over this book that I thought was, like, the worst book I read all year and was willfully uninteresting and completely just... doing whatever the fuck it wanted in the worst possible way.
I like willfully uninteresting.
Yeah. Oh, it was.
That's, yeah.
It has about 10 pages of sort of curiously fun writing and then 800 pages of gibberish.
I can't believe you read these long books. I just don't understand your attraction to
them. In my mind, I'm learning something when I read them. I'm learning what not to do.
Do you think your novel will be that long?
No, certainly not.
Then why read? Like, why pick those books? I just don't understand that choice.
I always read a short book and a long book at the same time and kind of go back and forth in between.
Yeah, I just haven't... It really has to be a promising book for me to even buy a 500-page book. I just know that if I could read three other books instead of that one, I'm going to read three other books.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't even know this Book of Numbers it's called.
Book of Numbers by Joshua Cohen. Don't read it. His short story collection that came out previously, which has like two good stories in it.
I'd never even heard of him before.
He's not great. He has, as we said, people occupying spaces that have been vacated or are like market inefficiencies. I guess when David Foster Wallace died, he was sort of like put a little crown on his head. He's very young and he writes a sort of avant-garde or... It's just unedited. It's not avant-garde. It's just unedited nonsense. That was probably the most painful book I read this year. And I read, like, I Hate My Selfie, which was an essay collection by a YouTube star.
Oh, my God. Why?
I sample myself to the entire buffet of our culture. Our literary culture. Lena Dunham, Aziz Ansari. Oh. These are the minds I want to attack.
I watched 5 minutes of that show.
Oh. I already did a podcast about that. We're not allowed to talk about it.
It was horrible.
It's very bad.
It was so, like, just the most cliche shit I've ever seen. I can't believe people are blowing their wads over it.
It's very pedantic and stupid.
People should be watching Casual on Hulu. That's just fucking great.
I can recommend a Hulu show on here.
It's so good, Carmen. It's like
Tell the listeners what Casual's about.
Oh, I mean, I'm not going to do that, but I mean, it's...
Why? I don't know what it's about. I want to know.
Michaela Watkins, who's really great. She was on SNL, and she's a psychiatrist who's, like, living with her brother. She has, like, a very age-inappropriate relationship with her daughter. The daughter is a really interesting character. She's, like, the 17-year-old who, like, is much older in her mind. And like makes her own sex tape and spreads it around the school so that her photography teacher will want to fuck her. It's a great show. And because it's on Hulu, you can do whatever. There's no ratings or anything like that.
Right.
That to me is what is most exciting about
streaming.
About streaming platforms, that there's no, you can fucking swear, you can show tits, like do whatever you want to do. There's no like FCC bullshit.
Which you have.
I have experiences with the FCC.
Submit this to the FCC and get you fined again.
You could.
Do you want to tell that story? I think it's a fun story.
Sure, I can tell the story.
Yeah, just tell me when you were fined by the FCC.
In college, I was asked to be on a radio program to talk about Elizabeth Warren, my friend's radio program.
Who we support.
I love Elizabeth Warren.
Love Elizabeth.
If she ran for president, I would quit my job and volunteer for her. And I said, no, I can't be on your program because I'm going to swear. And my friend said, you totally won't. There's a sign that's like lit up that says no swearing. You'll be fine. And I was like, okay, but you know, I'm nervous. And within 3 minutes, I dropped the F-bomb. And I had to pay the FCC $45.
$45?
And I still have the...
Is that per curse, or do you pay more?
I think it's just the minimum.
Flat rate?
It's a flat rate. Okay. I probably could have gotten some more F-bombs in there.
Well, in my mind, it would be like 45 for the first curse, 60 for the next curse, then like 100 for every curse thereafter.
But apparently somebody heard it and reported us. Like the FCC isn't monitoring
it. Sure, sure.
So somebody heard it and reported us. So fuck that person.
If you're listening, send Vincent his $45, you dick.
So Book of Numbers was not on there.
Well, I'm just saying, in terms of like a book that they lauded very widely,
that they did not.
They were more lukewarm on City on Fire, but I was still not happy that it was on the list.
It was on there,
yes.
I was bummed that You Too Can Have Body Like Mine was not on
That is... Might be my favorite book so far this year.
Yeah, I was surprised it wasn't on there.
Yes.
Considering
it was literally lauded in every single major period, including The Times.
Yeah, no one had a bad thing to say about that book. I don't think there was anything bad to say about it.
It's an insanely solid debut novel.
Huge omission. Binary Star, I love. But that was...
Is that this year?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I think it came out like in January.
Right.
But they might have...
Where did this statute of limitations...
Right,
which has put you at a real disadvantage in terms of these lists.
Totally. Yeah. If you don't come out in the summer or the spring, like, you're kind of fucked. Or fall.
Yeah.
So you really just don't want to come out in winter.
You want to come out... Yeah, yeah.
I love Binary Star, but that might be last year. Jim Shepherd's book wasn't on there, which I thought was a shocking omission. The Book of Aaron.
I've not read it.
Oh, it's beautiful. And I love Jim Shepherd. And I think it's, like, one of his better books. I thought that was, and that got a really good review in the Times. I mean, it's a Holocaust book. It's a great book. That wasn't on there. Gold of Fame Citrus, like we said, I was surprised that wasn't on there. No one read this book, but I loved The Tusk That Did the Damage by Tanya James. Yeah, no one read that book. Knopf put it out. I mean, no one read it. It's about elephants, and there's like an elephant narrator.
I can't understand why no one read that book.
I know. It's, I'm making it sound
horrible. Is this like a water for elephants?
No. It's such a great book, and it's I think it's like an important book, but yeah, no, it did not make it. Oh, and then Lydia Yuknovich is The Small Backs of Children. Mm. Not on there either. Disappointing.
See, they should consult mostly you, but maybe me too.
Well,
and you can put people on.
I read more books than you because they're shorter.
Sure.
Like, all the books I've just listed are like 200 pages or less. Mm-hmm. And you're reading like 800 page tomes. Yeah.
Do you do your Goodreads challenge every year?
No, I don't know. Okay. That is.
I do like I set a 52 book a year goal.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really care. I write down everything I read, but I don't keep track of it. I also really, the book that I am so crazy about now, which I don't think would qualify for, because it's not out yet, is Bird by Noy Holland. It's gorgeous. Counterpoint put it out, and I'm interviewing her for it. And it's a gorgeous...
Plug.
Yeah, it's
plug.
A plug. it's a gorgeous book. It's really stunning. The language is sort of... reminded me a lot of Emer McBride's A Girl is a Half-Form Thing, which is one of my favorite books.
Fantastic book.
And really, the language of this book, it made me feel what that book did. But yeah, I think it was probably too early. I was pissed that Mary Louise Parker's book wasn't on there.
Who knows if that fell in the time frame, though?
It must have. It came out like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm saying maybe the cutoff is,
maybe it is
November 1st or something.
It could be. My friend Lori Oswin's After the Parade, I really loved. That wasn't on there.
Finish up your plug so we can talk about Adam Johnson making fun of his wife.
Okay, the last one I'll plug is Dodie Bellamy is When the Sick Rule the World, which Semiotics put out, and it's beautiful and smart. Okay, let's talk about Adam Johnson.
So the final story in Adam Johnson's National Book Award winning Fortune Smiles.
Wait, is it the final story? Okay, right. So I read The Galley, and it wasn't the final story.
I think
Galley.
It was the final story in the one
I believe you.
But mine was a library ebook, so sometimes those are messed up too.
Well, the story is called Interesting Facts.
Interesting Facts is the title of the story, and this is a story told from the point of view of a woman who has breast cancer, whose husband has won the Pulitzer Prize. And
for a novel about
North Korea, and it's obviously Adam Johnson's life and wife in real life, who is also a writer to a lesser renown. And where do you think the morality lies in writing this story?
That's a tough question. Well, I interviewed Adam.
Obviously, you can't answer your process was behind creating it, but...
I interviewed Adam Johnson about that book.
Because this is the type of story that I read, and then I show this to my girlfriend, and I'm like, what would you do if I did this? And she says, oh, I would leave you.
Right. I don't think... Maybe
our relationship isn't as strong.
I think that story... I just think it's a wonderful
story. It's an amazing story.
I think at the center, I interviewed him, and he said this, and I am inclined to agree and believe him, that it was really, it came from a place of needing to compartmentalize chaos and having a curiosity about, a deep curiosity about what it was like to be on the other side of that experience.
Totally.
Because his wife really did have breast cancer.
Yeah.
They really do have kids, you know, this was something very real that happened in their life. In terms of, you know, him imagining himself into his wife's writing life, that part I would not have done, probably. You know, because he doesn't say that, I mean, he says, he indicts himself as having sort of stolen ideas from her.
Sure.
For a story that is in that collection, which is so amazing, the Dark Meadow story.
Yeah.
Which is like probably the best story I've read in a long time. So he indicts himself plenty, I think, in that story.
I think the Nirvana one might be my favorite.
I really like that one. I mean, that's a great story, too. Yeah. The Dark Meadow, I just thought, was unbelievable.
It's great stuff.
To end a story with a fucking pedophile jerking off with the flowers. Like, yes. It's like, it reminded me so much of those, like, Todd Solondz movies.
I was very excited. Oh, I love Todd Solondz
movies. Like Happiness. That sort of aesthetic and that ethos feels very much a part of that. Yeah, but I love Adam Johnson. I actually have not read the novel, The Orphan Master's
Son. It's very solid. I think it might have profited from a very weak year in terms of competition, but it's an extremely solid novel with a very, you know, a world that you don't usually have access to.
Right, right. But I have not read that, but I've read both of his collections, and they're both wonderful.
Yes.
He is and every story in that book, I think, is really great. Even The Hurricane Story, which I don't... I didn't love, I still thought really pulled something off and was exciting to me.
If you get a short story collection, that's 5 out of 6, like, amazing stories. It's like, that's once every 5 years that happens.
Absolutely, yeah. And he deserved the National Book Award.
Very deservedly.
And I was shocked that he won.
Me too. No, I was waiting for a book that I hated to.
Right. Well, I just thought that Anya was going to win everything. Yes. It was a huge book, and, it, you know. But he seemed shocked, too, when you watched the video. I think he was quite shocked as well.
Sure.
And I was happy that Ta-Nehisi Coates won for nonfiction. That seemed... No, I'm not out of, like, political correctness. I think it's a great book.
I think it's a really bad book.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's extremely ugly on the sentence level, and it's written with an expediency that, in my mind, I can feel his agent breathing down his neck when I read it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it kind of felt like stocking stuff for racial commentary in terms of his journalism on The Atlantic.
Yeah, maybe I went into it loving, just because I love his stuff on The Atlantic so much, I pardoned a lot of that stuff.
Sure.
It's not as good a book as The Argonauts, which was not nominated for...
Sure.
Which is a huge omission. And Visiting Privilege wasn't nominated for anything.
It felt tone deaf in ways to me that I didn't appreciate. Him going to France to escape racism is, like, the most insane. And fact that he has no self-awareness about him, he talks about how, like, Black people chasing the dream is ridiculous, and yet he's literally living a white person's dream of living on the Upper West Side of New York and writing for The Atlantic and being an extremely widely read literary author. And I would just need more, like, I think James Baldwin does that. Like, he's very, very aware of his place in the culture and its relation to white literary culture, and I think Ta-Nehisi Coates is a little more deaf to that.
That's a fair criticism, probably, yeah.
Also, I just think his sentences are, like, awful. Like,
they're clunky.
The worst anaphora use ever. It's just like, let's start the sentence with the same word every fucking paragraph for 100 paragraphs in a row. And also, I don't think he knew that bro who got killed at his school. I think he met him at a party and was like, this is going to be great for my book.
I don't think that's true. I think that is...
Yeah, I'm overstepping there.
That is not fair.
I'll bring it back.
But, I think that's probably a fair criticism of the book.
Yeah.
I thought it was a smart book and a heartfelt book.
I thought it was heartfelt.
Sure. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
And you know, he's just a pleasure to read in The Atlantic.
Oh my God. He's an amazing long-form journalist.
Yeah, the reparations.
It's one of the most important essays you'll ever read in your life.
Yeah. I wonder why they didn't do this. Like
in my mind, you would have that, the reparations essay and the, like, generational poverty essay just in that book, too. Yeah, like, why not have it? Then I think that makes the book less saleable. And if you attach, like, an argument for reparations in that book, which is obviously, like, meant for white people to read.
Sure, yeah.
Also, I'm against, like, how this book is 115 pages and it costs $30. So, like, obviously it's really important that black people should read this book.
Right.
And yet it has, like, a prohibitive price point. Mm-hmm.
I bought it on my Kindle, so I didn't even think about how much it was. It was like $10 on the Kindle. Sure. Is it really $30?
Yeah, it's like $27 with tax. It's like $25 publisher's price. Yeah.
I feel that way about a lot of... books are... audiobooks is... I am shocked how expensive audiobooks are. It's bullshit. $30 for an audiobook? What the fuck? Where do you get off of? It's like an MP3 track. Like, it costs nothing to make.
It's counterproductive to the, like...
Completely.
The production of literature and...
I'm trying to, like, get into audiobooks, and now I have no interest.
You have to... But I also guess you also have to rationalize, like, if they're going to sell 100 million copies of Twilight, they obviously have to have a comparable price point for literary books, otherwise people won't. Yeah, but, like, you make so much money by charging $30 across the board than you do charging, like, $30 and $15.
Right, that's fair.
But, I mean, it's bound paper with ink on it. Like, get the fuck over
and it. An audiobook is literally an MP3 file. Like, that costs nothing.
Nothing. Well, e-books are free, too.
They paid, you know, that person who read that book probably $3,000 for that book.
If that.
It's pure profit.
Yeah.
I actually emailed, you know, you can keep this on the podcast or keep it in, I don't care.
I'll let it out.
On Amazon, it said, like, in February, there was an audiobook of the Joy Williams stories coming out from this, like, Blackstone audio. So I emailed them and I was like, what's the deal? Like, is that really a thing? Cause I fucking know Joy's not reading those stories in a fucking studio. and he was like, it's true. We haven't even chosen our narrator yet. Like, da da da. I was like, I'm going to fucking throw my hat in the ring. Fly me to Portland, pay me enough to, like, live in a hotel for a week and I'll fucking read those stories. I know them better than anyone else. I really do think I'm the preeminent scholar Andre Williams.
That's a great flag to carry.
I think I am.
Also, you have no competition, though. Except That's Don DeLillo.
Yeah, he loves her. There's no way he's read her as many times as I have.
Maybe not.
I have read State of Grace probably 15 times. And Quick and the Dead probably 10 times. Like, I know those books. But yeah, Don DeLillo does love her. And I like Don DeLillo. I'm excited about the new one. That's going to be good.
I love Don DeLillo. I think he might have peaked. I think he might have peaked.
What the fuck is that new book called? Point?
I didn't read the press release.
It's something K. Zero K? I don't know.
That sounds right.
Something like that. Rachel Kushner loves him, too. And I love her. Oh, Rachel Kushner's book wasn't on there.
Yes.
I was bummed about that, too. That was a very good book. The Strange Case of Rachel K. by New Directions.
Didn't read it.
So it's like three stories.
Okay.
And that was like $20, too.
Don DeLillo's... Him and Joy Williams probably... it's strange. Like, they seem to be of the same side of the coin. Totally. And yet, because she's a woman, she receives so much less recognition. Totally. And I think they're probably the two best sentence-level writers.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And funny, too. They're both wickedly funny people. They're doing an event, like, this week, I think, in New York, that I would love to be at, just to hear them talk to each other.
It's what we miss out on.
I know. But I know, it's true. Like, we don't get... We have some people coming to Austin, but...
Jonathan Franzen came here.
I saw him. I didn't go to the reading, but I saw him at the bookstore because I went earlier that day to pick up something. I saw him there. I was like, what is he doing here? And then I was like, oh, he's reading here tonight.
Well, that's everyone's reaction when they see Jonathan
Franzen. What is he doing here? Oh, no! And Mary, I think he was with Mary Carr.
Okay.
She had read there the day before.
Oh, fun.
And I like her a lot as well. Although I've not read her poetry. I hear it's quite bad.
I have not read her poetry. Her memoir. Her memoir is so great.
And Lit is great, too. Are we?
We're almost done. We're going to talk about your... we're talking about Joy Williams, who lives in Key West. We're going to talk about the Key West Literary Prize you just won.
Sure.
Who is the Cecilia Joyce Johnson Fiction Award, which you recently received?
Yes. What did you want to talk about?
Just what it is, what it comprises, what you have to do, how you applied.
I applied because the lineup is great. Joy is a headliner. Karen Russell is there. Jim Shepherd, Victor Laval, Yi Yun Lee, tons of people. I mean, really, Hilton Owls. A lot of people that I'm excited by. So I applied and I sent a story. Their max was 15 pages, so I sent a story that was under that, and they chose it. There's three prizes, awards, whatever you call them, and they all did go to white men.
And you did not, as a feminist, reject the award.
I did not, as a feminist, reject the award.
As I would have.
Horseshit.
I didn't apply because I knew that this was a gendered...
You're so bullshit, Carmen. I did not reject it because I'm, at the end of the day, I just want to go, I want to see Joy and Karen.
Of course.
But it was the first thing I noticed when they made the announcement. It was the first thing I noticed that all three awards went to, you know, white guys. But I also have no data on how many, you know, people of color are applying for this, how many women are applying for this.
Sure. You were three of the only ones who applied.
For all I know, that could be the case. But it definitely was something I noticed. And, what can you say about it?
Do better next year.
Yeah, hopefully. And I think in previous years they've done better.
But it's a blind. I'm sure. Is it a blind?
They're totally blind.
Yeah, okay.
It's totally blind. Yeah, they were specifically, you know, they said don't put your name on the manuscript.
Yeah.
But they've
obviously been trained by the canon to be predisposed to white male narratives.
Well, I usually write female narratives too, but that story is a guy, is a father with a schizophrenic daughter. That's total easy pathos.
Yeah.
How could he not choose that
story? What a cheap trick.
What a cheap trick. I'm excited for it. It'll be in January. Well,
congratulations.
Thanks so much.
You plugged 100 different books. Like, which book should people read that isn't on the New York Times notable list?
I mean, I plugged some.
Yeah, you plugged 100.
Should
we say You Two Have a Body Like Mine? Because we both agree that should have been on the list.
It's a wonderful book, and it's a strange book. And I think it also...
It's a wonderfully strange book.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people will enjoy it. I think it's a book that's not for everybody, but I think a lot of people will like it.
It's more mainstream than it presents itself as.
Right, very handsome cover. Very handsome cover. Alexandra is a very smart person. I was very surprised that that wasn't on there. I would also say the book I was talking about, Bird, by Noy Holland. I was very excited by that book. I think it's out. Maybe it's out now from Counterpoint, but I read it a few weeks ago in galley form. And she is a very great writer who is really not read very much by the masses. So I would say that book.
I'll recommend a book you hated, The Hall of Small Mammals by Thomas Pierce.
It's not for me.
It has three, we talked about there a story collection having five of six great stories. I think there's three great stories in that book. And at least in terms of other collections I've read this year, it felt very, very newish to me. At least in terms, it's like in between.
It wasn't the first three stories that were good.
Shirley Temple 3? You don't like the one about the woolly mammoth? No. Oh, I think it's a very, the relationship between the mother and the son reminds me of my mother and myself. I'm probably bringing biases, but there's at least three, I think, really strong stories in there. There's the one about the sex tape, Ba Ba Voom.
I didn't read that one.
It's a really solid one. And then there's a good story about like a drone alarms in the sky.
I just thought his sentences were very guarded in some way. Like his language didn't feel very exploratory, though his stories felt exploratory.
I think that's the strength of them, that he has a very, very declarative sentence style that mixes with a more absurd sort of subject matter. And I think it obviously could be like, oh, this is a George Saunders ripoff, but I think
his language is different than
his
Saunders.
Is a lot more, it seems less gimmicky.
I'm also not a Saunders person, so
I can show you that tattoo too.
Do you have a Saunders tattoo? Yeah. Oh my god, you're so white.
that's a great note to end on.
I'm definitely like the opposite of you in a lot of ways. Which is why I agreed to come on this podcast.
Yes, thank you for coming.
Of course, because I do respect you a lot.
Oh, good.
You're very funny. I'm very smart.
That's it. We're ending on that. I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing.